This is Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston, and you're listening to Being Catholic right here on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5 FM in good old McLean County, 92.5 in Bloomington Normal, 88.3 in Pontiac, in Livingston County, and 97.1 in Lincoln and Logan County. So we're up and down the good old double nickel, Highway 55, Interstate 55, for 110 miles and on both sides of the road. And if you would like to be a sponsor of the Catholic Spirit Radio, you can call our station at 807-2427. That's 309-807-2427. Again, that's 309-807-2427. Or you can go to our website, CatholicSpiritRadio.com. Again, that's CatholicSpiritRadio.com. And it'll tell you there how you can be a sponsor if you're a business and you'd like to get your name out there. We can do that for you. And for those people out there who would like to make a donation, you can find that information also on our website. It's the best place to go. So we're going to have a great show for you today. I'm here with my wife, Lynn, and we're talking about literature, What Every Catholic Should Know, a book written by Joseph Pierce. And we'll talk a little bit more about that today. We talked last week about Chaucer, and today we're going to talk a little bit about Thomas More and utopian literature. But first, I'm going to turn this over to my wife, Lynn. She wants to talk a little bit about Eucharistic miracles, and Epiphany Parish is going to have, from October 1st, I think, to October 6th, a display of information about Eucharistic miracles. And Lynn will talk a little bit more about that, so I'm going to turn it over to her.
Yes, Epiphany Parish in Normal, it's going to have host the Vatican International Exhibition of the Eucharistic Miracles of the World. And this will be from Tuesday, October 1st through Sunday, October 6th in the Parish Hall at Epiphany. And that's at 1000 East College Avenue in Normal. This exhibit tells the story of more than 120 church-recognized miracles from all over the world, which occurred through the last 1500s. This event is free and open to the public during the hours of, on Tuesday, October 1st, it'll be from 7:30 a.m. till 5 p.m. On Wednesday, 7:30 a.m. to 8:30 p.m. On Thursday, October 3rd, it'll be 7:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. And Friday, October 4th, 7:30 a.m. till 8 p.m. Saturday, 8 a.m. until 7 p.m. And Sunday, 8 a.m. till 6 p.m. A special evening will be October 2nd on Wednesday, and it will begin with the Mass and music and adoration. The exhibition will be open afterwards for viewing. All is free. Donations will be collected as if you wish to donate for this. The Adoration Society, which promotes the exhibition in the United States, is responsible for bringing it here. Epiphany is handicapped accessible. The exhibit consists of poster panels with text and images. If you have any questions, call the parish at 452-2585. So this should be a really great thing. I can't wait to see and find out more about it. I do know that some of the relics that we have from the Eucharist, the host has bled and stuff, and they've preserved for over the last 15,000 years. They were tested, and this is human blood, and it's AB negative, I believe, and the same blood type as on the Shroud of Turin. So, you know, this is really something to see. I can't wait to do it.
The Eucharistic miracles are really interesting. I know we did a show one time and talked about some of them, and there is a good book, I think, in the Epiphany Church Library, if you'd like to, you know, look there. On Eucharistic miracles, we used to have that at home a couple of times because I think we did some show on it, and then maybe also when we taught RCIA, we might have done a little bit on that as well, didn't we, Lynn?
Yeah, I believe so.
And they were very, very, very interesting. And this should be a really great display and an interesting topic. And the more you can find out about it, the more I think impressed you'll be with the Eucharist itself. And I think probably one of the emphases on this is, especially for our young people, a lot of people in our secular society have fallen away from, and including Catholics, from the belief in the, you know, literalness of the Eucharist, the fact that it is Christ's, you know, body, blood, soul, and divinity in the Eucharistic wafer itself. And so that needs to be restored because it's extremely important, and this was taught by the early church and by Christ himself right from the very beginning. And you'll find, I think, a lot of these miracles substantiate the Eucharist itself. And so it's a good thing to attend, and especially if you have children or younger people, to get them to attend as well. Don't you think, Lynn?
Yes, I do. And by the way, I believe it's next week, isn't it, the 14th? Someone will be on talking about that on this program.
Exactly. I was just going to mention that. We'll have a guest here next week. We won't be talking about the literature next week because we'll have a guest, Charlotte Glass, and she is going to talk about Eucharistic miracles and share with us information about some of the Eucharistic miracles, you know, over the past, as Lynn was saying, about 1,500 years. I think that was 1,500, not 15,000. And I remember last week I was getting Joseph Pierce and Joseph Smith mixed up. And this week, I think you're getting the number of years over which the Eucharistic miracles occurred a little bit mixed up. It's so easy to do when you're on radio. You're looking at various things, and it's easy to see one thing for another. And I just couldn't get Joseph Smith out of my head last week, remember, the week before.
Yes, it was last week, I believe.
I kept calling Joseph Pierce Joseph Smith. And, of course, Joseph Smith was the founder of, you know, the Church of the Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints, and he has nothing to do with Joseph Pierce, but I kept substituting, so that happens. But at any rate, Charlotte Glass will be with us next week. That's the 7th, and she will be talking with me.
Much later than the 7th, is it? 14th?
The 14th. I'm 15? Sorry. Today is the 7th. So, yeah, it'll be next week, a week from today, the 14th, Saturday the 14th.
Don't mind us. We don't know what day of the week it is.
And Charlotte Glass will be here, and she'll be talking about what's going on at Epiphany, and she'll be talking about the Eucharistic miracles with me. It'll be a very interesting show, so make sure you tune in.
Right.
But at any rate, today we're going to talk a little bit more about Joseph Pierce's literature, what every Catholic should know, and we're going to talk about Thomas More today. And Thomas More sort of paved the way for what has become the utopian and dystopian literature, you know, of modern literature of today. A lot of it's science fiction, for example. And he wrote the first story based on that idea of some utopia. He wrote that word O-U-T-O-P-I-A-N, utopia, or O-U-T-O-P-I-A. And utopia, and it meant no place. And of course, there's utopia, E-W-T-O-P-I-A, utopia, meaning good place. And then there's dystopian literature, meaning dystopia, meaning bad place. And so that whole body of literature, it was sort of pioneered by Sir Thomas More. And so we're going to talk about that today.
I think one of the things to be aware of, Sir Thomas More was a Chancellor of England under Henry VIII, and because he of Henry VIII's trying to divorce his first wife, Catherine, and the church not allowing him to, he did marry Anne Boleyn anyway, and he wanted More and all the people that served him to sign that they would promote and recognize the succession if she had any children. And More refused to do so. And as a result, he was martyred.
Yeah, the church would not give More, you know, we wouldn't call it a divorce, but they wouldn't nullify his marriage, his current
Henry's,
marriage,
yeah.
Or Henry's rather, not Thomas More's, Henry's current marriage. And so Henry defied the church, and then Henry named himself as being the head of the church in England.
And this Moore couldn't tolerate. He said there was no way that he could accept a king being head of the church.
Exactly. And so in the long run, Thomas Moore was executed. He had his head cut off.
Right. When he went up to the scaffold, he moved his beard out of the way because he said the beard did not offend the king.
Yeah.
And he just...
I think he said to the people there, he said, you know, I am the king's loyal servant, but God's first. And that's how he phrased it. He said, in other words, but Henry would not be dissuaded, and Henry executed him anyway, in spite of the fact that many, many people tried to stop Henry from doing such a thing. And that set the stage, really, for what became the Protestant Revolution. It never really would have happened the way it did had not King Henry VIII left the Catholic Church in the sense that he became the head of the church in England, and then you had the development of the Anglican Church, and that contributed to the so-called Protestant Reformation. Without that, most likely Luther's Reformation in Germany would have died.
Right, and Moore believed he was not dying because he committed treason against the king and the state, but for the faith of the Catholic Church. 400 years later, he was canonized.
Yeah, he was a very, very brave man. He was a very, very good father. I mean, he had a son-in-law who was Protestant, and yet they got along, and, you know, they were able to interact with each other and accept that and so forth. But he stood strongly as a Catholic, you know, for the teaching of the church. And on that particular issue, he simply wouldn't be moved. And it cost him his life. So he was...
Right.
One of the first martyrs of the so-called Reformation. And I use that word so-called because it really wasn't a Reformation. It was a leaving of the Catholic Church. And it was the Catholic Church itself that reformed itself and is always doing so all the time because it constantly needs reform. And so does every church, really, because the human race constantly needs reform. If you have people in the church, there's going to be sinners. And we talked about that last week. On all the scandal that's going on today. Christ said to expect it, so that's what we talked about a little bit last week. But let's move on to Thomas Moore then and the utopian literature, and we'll talk about some of the literature that is, you know, that exists today, that came into existence today because of this precedent set back in that time by Thomas Moore. Utopia was first published in 1516, so that's, 500 years ago. And so it can be considered the progenitor of the genre of utopian fiction, as well as being a major milestone in the evolution of fantasy literature in general. The fact that utopia, as employed by Moore, means no place or nowhere, from the Greek ou, meaning not, and topos, meaning place. And that is as opposed to good place, from the Greek eu, meaning good, and topos, meaning place. So Moore did not write a book about the utopia that we like to think of, you know, being a perfect place. And it's a fact that's all too forgotten by modern critics who lack the subtlety to see the true intent of Moore's satire. Supposing that Moore meant utopia, not utopia, these critics have concluded quite erroneously that Moore was more of a humanist than he was a Christian, or even more absurdly, that he was a proto-communist. Where they get this, I don't know. I guess it's just this effort, for example, to science, to sort of prop up the respectability of communism, which, of course, is not propped up at all by the Catholic faith. For a man who willingly laid down his life for his friends and his faith, such conclusions lack all credibility. Although Moore used the medium of Christian fantasy as a vehicle for voicing criticisms of the cruelty and corruption of the times in which he lived, his purpose in writing the satire went beyond the temporal to the eternal. In the final analysis, Moore's utopia can be seen much more as a dystopia than a utopia, depicting a world of self-evident absurdities based upon erroneous conceptions of reality, though woven within the dystopian framework are what might be called utopian elements, such as the importance placed on the contemplative life and the efforts made to counter the evils of avarice. And Moore was a very contemplative person. I mean, he was one of these. There's a play written about Thomas Moore called A Man for All Seasons, meaning that, you know, he was one of these sort of Renaissance type men. He did many, many things, and so a very, very busy man, and working with government. He was a lawyer, worked with the king, had a lot of things, and yet he was a great family man, took care of his wife and his children well, and just did, you know, wrote and just did many, many things that most people would never find the time to do, just like Chaucer. Chaucer was a very worldly man, so was Thomas More, and yet at the same time, he was very religious, both were, and both had found the time to write. In writing his Utopia, More established a whole new genre of fantasy literature, the utopian or dystopian fantasy, in which imaginary worlds are created as a reflection or as a way of seeing the real world. From Swift's Gulliver Travels to Orwell's 1984, More's originality has inspired generations of writers to hold a utopian mirror to the world in which they lived. Gulliver's Travels by the 18th century author Jonathan Swift developed the utopian genre into what is perhaps the progenitor of science fiction. Swift introduces us to weird alien creatures such as the Platonic equine Unanims and the bestial humanoid Yehus, and presents us with the scientific wonders of floating islands and the scientific blunders of mad scientists. Yet he was not writing merely to exercise a scientific imagination, but to exorcise the nonsense of modernism and scientism. And that's one thing we want to talk about, because scientism is still with us today. And scientism is different than science in a sense that scientism is the idea, the assertion, that the only real knowledge is found through empirical means, that any non-empirical means of arriving at knowledge is not really valid knowledge, that only the scientific method of discovering things and arriving at knowledge is valid. And, of course, you know, it refutes itself, as we'll come back and explain after the break. But we're going to go ahead and talk a little bit more about scientism and the nonsense of it that is still going on, and much of it that went on through the 18th century and changed our philosophy and everything else. It's never really been proven. It's just been assumed, and it's very, very easy to disprove, and we'll do that shortly. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
Catholic Radio, changing hearts and minds.
Found your station about a month ago, and I have never turned my station off since I found you. Every time something I take offense to comes up, y'all answer it almost immediately. It's to make me see through with prayer. Thank you so much for saving me.
We depend on your support to keep Catholic Spirit Radio on the air 24 hours a day, broadcasting the truth and beauty of the Catholic Church.
The Catechism of the Catholic Church refers to the Sacrament of Reconciliation as one of conversion, for it has so much to do with returning to God the Father. Just as our view of prayer changes from a child's petitioning to a mature relationship with God, this same maturing process exists with the sacraments. Penance, confession, reconciliation, different names for the same process. Eucharist, communion, the Lord's Supper, the same celebration. As we look more closely at these sacraments, we realize these are the sacraments of maturing. These are both a key part of our lifelong process of our Lord calling us to a closer place. Just as Jesus fell with the cross, got up, and eventually overcame death with the resurrection, the process of penance to Eucharist is God's same invitation, a transformation to a new life. This has been a bit of Catholic encouragement from Michael Gisondi.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston. You're listening to Being Catholic right here on Catholic Spirit Radio. We're back from our break, and we're talking about Thomas More and the utopian literature that he laid the foundations for. And we're taking that from the book Literature, What Every Catholic Should Know by Joseph Pierce. And we're talking here about the scientism in Moore's Utopia, the book, the work of literature that he wrote, and in it he is exorcising, that is, he is showing up the nonsense of this modernism scientism, this idea that all knowledge is scientific, all knowledge is empirical. And that's exactly what scientism teaches. But the whole way of refuting that is simply to take a look at that statement. The statement, all knowledge is empirical, is not an empirical statement. So if all knowledge is empirical, then the statement itself must not be true because it's not an empirical statement. There's no way that you can show empirically, that is by the scientific method, that all knowledge, you know, is scientific. You can't prove that. There's no possible way to show that empirically. So if you can't use the method to show it, and that's the only method that is valid, then the statement itself is not valid. So it refutes itself. In other words, it's one of those statements where if it's true, then it's false. And if it's false, of course, it's false. So either way, it's false. And, of course, we know that there's lots of knowledge that is simply not scientific at all. So what is justice, for example? We can't scientifically arrive at any conclusions about justice, and yet scientists, you know, use that all the time. They arrive at all kinds of judgments about various things, good, bad, and indifferent. And, of course, they can't arrive at those judgments by any empirical method at all. So to try and say that all knowledge to be valid has to be empirical is simply getting rid of most of the knowledge that science itself is based on. So it doesn't work. And while science is a very good thing, and we get a lot of knowledge from science, scientism is not. And it's like a mechanic, for example, saying that the only knowledge worth knowing is mechanical, or electrical engineer saying that the only knowledge worth knowing, you know, is electrical, and so on. All of those things are fine and good, and mechanical knowledge is good, and electrical knowledge is good, and other types of knowledge are good, but they're not the one and only thing. And so scientism is very, very easy and simple to disprove. When people come and make statements like that, just point out to them the very statement that you're making is not empirical in the first place. So if your statement is true, then the statement by its own definition is false. It's as simple as that.
Is this the same scientific type of religion that Tom Cruise and all those stars belong to, that Ron Hubbard's stuff?
Oh, that's a little bit, it's something similar, but okay. It's a little bit different. I forget what that's called.
Scientology
is what that's called. I think it is a form of scientism, really, this idea, you know, Scientology.
So that started a long time ago then.
Oh, scientism, yeah, it's been around probably forever in a way, probably before science was developed, there was such a thing as people trying to say, you know, the factual knowledge is the only knowledge, and you know that's what they were aiming at anyhow. It doesn't work. It is theology and philosophy that inform and inspire the best science fiction, regardless of how many spaceships, time machines, and five-legged aliens are employed in the plot. So if we write, you know, science fiction novels, those novels are written for a purpose other than the science fiction. That's just a medium by which the person writing the novel or the short story is using to convey a truth that he wants to get across, and that truth is usually about human nature or human society, and we'll talk about those things as we go along here. As for the ongoing tradition of utopian literature, later utopian writers follow in Moore's footsteps in terms of etymology, that is, using, you know, the root of the word, using the term as being literally no place. This is seen in the titles of Victorian utopian literature, such as William Morris's News from Nowhere and Samuel Butler's Erewhon, which is an anagram of nowhere. In other words, it's nowhere spelled backwards. Far from being a good place, most of the great utopian visions in literature have been dystopian, which means bad place, from the Greek deus, bad, and topos, place. We think perhaps in 20th century literature of three great works of dystopian literature: Lord of the World by Robert Hugh Benson, Brave New World by Aldous Huxley, and 1984 by George Orwell. Although only the first of this triumvirate of novels was written by a Catholic, all three of them serve as timely warnings of how secularist ideas lead to nightmare realities. But are such utopian visions important enough to warrant our concern? Should we care whether an imaginary place is good or bad? Is it not literally nowhere in the sense that it does not exist? So why should we concern ourselves with such fantasies about worlds which are the fertile or furtive figments of a writer's dreams or nightmares? Should we not keep our feet firmly grounded in the real world in which we live and not allow our heads to drift into the clouds of Neverland? It is in the consideration of these questions that the distinction between the various etymological definitions of utopia become important. Neverland might be nowhere, but it is there an ultimate, but is there an ultimate good place, a forever land where good people live happily ever after? In other words, is there a truth to be found in fiction or in fairy tales or in utopian fantasies? In one sense, such questions can be answered in utilitarian terms. The fact is that we need to be shown visions of the person we are meant to be and also visions of the society in which we are meant to live. As Christ, the perfect person, shows us who we should be, utopia, insofar as it is genuinely utopia, shows us the sort of society in which we should live. Although we will never be perfect as Christ is perfect, we are nonetheless called to strive towards perfection, which is the call to holiness. Similarly, although we will never have heaven on earth, we should strive to bring earth closer to heaven, which is the call to make the earth a better place, a good place, utopia. The fact that we are miserable sinners does not mean that we should not take the sinless one as our model. The fact that our society is full of miserable sinners, ourselves included, does not mean that we should not strive to make our society a good place. Even if the frailty and sinfulness of fallen human nature will mean that the good place to which we strive will never be a perfect place, it is sufficient to know that efforts toward the good place generally make the world a better place. So Joseph Pierce is answering that question. Yes, utopian and fantasy and literature, even science fiction, is good and necessary to show us what the world could be like. You know, at least a perfect place can help us make the world a better place, even though we could never make it a perfect place. It is for this reason that the utopian visions of the great writers, such as J.R.R. Tolkien, you know, who wrote Lord of the Rings, who shows us an agrarian utopia in his depiction of this year, should be valued as a source of inspiration that leads to the aspiration to make our own world a better place. There are, however, other ways of showing us utopia, such as the way of the satire adopted by Moore in his Utopia and by Swift in Gulliver's Travels. These great satirists show us utopia, meaning nowhere, as a scathingly satirical mirror of our own world caricatured through the process of reductio ad absurdum, meaning reducing our world to the absurd and then seeing how absurd some of the things that we do are. And we could certainly look at what's going on today for sure and see a lot of absurdities in our own world, the ridiculousness. In seeing our own corrupt society in ugly and absurd caricature, we are shocked out of our complacent comfort zones into seeking a better and more just society. In this sense, the satirical depiction of utopia inspires the vision of utopia, meaning that, you know, the utopia, the no place, inspires a vision of the good place. The other means of inspiring the desire for utopia are via the via negativa of dystopian fiction, such as in the aforementioned works by Benson, Huxley, and Orwell. These authors present us with visions of the bad place that could become reality if certain inherent tendencies in our own world are not countered and checked. In Benson's dystopia, we see the dangers of secularism and the rise of the popular demagogue. And, of course, we can see that in our own world. You know, the secular is getting worse and worse. And there are many, many demagogues and have been. Hitler was a demagogue, for example, demagoguing the people. We have a lot of demagogues right here in America who use all kinds of scare tactics and so forth to gain their own ends and cause endless trouble in society.
Just look at the people running for office, especially on they want to change everything.
Exactly.
They want to control everything.
That's exactly what they want to do, is control.
What you eat, how you...
Power and control.
Mm-hmm.
And we see this in Huxley, The Dangers of Hedonism and the Heedless Numbness of Comfort Addiction, If you read, you know, Huxley's Brave New World, everybody in it is perfectly taken care of, and they're constantly on a drug, you know, called Soma, that causes them to be have a constant high, but it doesn't have any negative physical, you know, side effects. And they're involved constantly in a world of TV screens and mostly soap operas. And the people then are kept harmless that way and controlled completely by the powers that be. And we see a lot of this in various authors, the huge corporation taking over society or the huge state taking over society. We have Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451, for example, a science fiction novel in which the firemen of the day are people who burn books. They're book burners. These are the firemen. Because books can cause people to be unhappy. You know, it can disturb their peace. It can show them that the way they're living is not the proper way. And so books have to be banned and novels and so forth have to be burned. In other words, the opposite of what a fireman does in the real world today.
That really surprised me. I didn't know anything about that story until I think we saw the movie.
Yeah.
And I was just shocked. They're running around burning books.
But, I mean, we're having a lot of this call for censorship today.
Oh, yes.
You know, if you don't like something.
Even Tom Sawyer.
Yeah, if you don't like something, you know, censor it. And this idea, somehow or another, we have to have a tolerance, tolerance, tolerance. Isn't that what you had in Elvis Huxley's Brave New World?
Yes.
Soma, soma, soma. Everybody just chill out and don't be concerned with anything. Let's all just enjoy and have a good time. We have a lot of that hedonism in our society right now going on. It goes without saying that our understanding of what is good determines our understanding of what is a good society. And if we have a false and fallacious understanding of the good, our utopian dreams will metamorphose into dystopian nightmares. And I think you mentioned it, Lynn, the green movement, for example. You know,
yes.
It's a form of worship of the earth, the worship of the creation instead of the creator. And it can become, and it's a good thing to be to conserve what we are given.
You need to be a good steward of the things you've been given, but when you carry it to the point where you're taking care of the trees and don't want to hurt a tree, and you kill babies before they're born, this is insane.
Yes, it is. I mean, it's in other words, we need to be able to step out and see ourselves, and some of these authors enable us to do that. If we have a false and fallacious understanding of the good, our utopian dreams turn into nightmares. This is what happened to the utopian dream of Rousseau, whose noble savage transformed vampire-like into the ignoble savagery of the French Revolution. Rousseau ran around talking about the perfect human being, the noble savage, you know, the person in nature, that somehow people were born completely in nature and they were divorced from the artificial world of civilization. They would be good and perfect people and so forth. And there is no such thing. I mean, there isn't this golden age with this golden person anywhere. The reality was is that people around the world, whether they were, you know, savages in nature or not, are human beings, and they have a human nature, and they're prone to all of the foils and foibles and follies and sinfulness of human beings anywhere. So, you know, scratch a native, you know, in his native environment, and you'll still find a human being underneath, so. And actually, these kind of dreams can turn into what happened with the French Revolution. The French Revolution followed the American Revolution and was modeled on it, really. And they were going to transform society into a utopia. They were going to have this society that would be, they were going to get rid of God. Everything was going to be based on fact. Everything was, in effect, it was going to be scientism. Everything was going to be based on the material. And they were going to have a world without classes. People all would be equal and all of that kind of, and it turned into a, and when people didn't go along with this because of the power these people were exercising for people to conform to their fantastic ideas, there was, you know, horrible wars broke out, and there was millions, you know, literally killed in France and slaughtered and bloodshed and so forth. One of our own founders, Thomas Jefferson, actually approved of this. He actually wrote to Sam Adams and said that, it was John Adams. He wrote to John Adams and said that all this bloodshed and so forth was necessary and it would be worth it if we would have a perfect empire of liberty. In other words, this is what the French revolutionists were after, this perfect,
yeah, he's looking for utopia,
peaceful, wonderful empire of utopian liberty. It didn't work. It fell apart, and it was taken over by Napoleon. In other words, instead of getting this utopian world, they got a dystopia for real. And if you read about the Vendée in France, where all of the Catholics who opposed this thing were slaughtered, and then finally when the whole thing fell apart, and Napoleon took the whole country over, you know, they in effect got what they deserved, but it was a lot of bloodshed and nightmare to go through. And, of course, this happened again later on with the communist revolution in Russia and also in China. And chasing after all these utopias usually ends up in a dystopia because you don't see people as they really are. So that's what happened to the utopian dreams of Marx. And that's what's happening to the utopian dreams of radical relativism that we have in our own day. They turn into the eugenic nightmare of institutionalized infanticide, which is abortion, and institutionalized geriatricide, which is euthanasia, you know, of elderly people, and convincing people that they're better off dead than suffering. And Christianity teaches that suffering can be a good thing. It's not good in the sense that we want it, but if it happens to us, which it will, we can turn that suffering into something good for ourselves and society if we follow, you know, the teachings of Jesus Christ. So in the midst of the madness of so many dystopias, real and imagined, is the vision of utopia, which shows us the vision of sanity and which keeps us sane. And we'll have to come back and talk about this a little more and finish it after this break. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
Catholic Radio, changing hearts and minds.
My Protestant church family, we are pro-life. But there's something more that I'm getting from Catholic Radio and the teaching and the discussion. And I've learned so much.
We depend on your support to keep Catholic Spirit Radio on the air 24 hours a day, broadcasting the truth and beauty of the Catholic Church.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston. You're listening to Being Catholic right here on Catholic Spirit Radio. We're back from our break. We're talking about Thomas More and the basis of utopian literature. And we're taking it from the book by Joseph Pierce, Literature, What Every Catholic Should Know. And we've been talking about some of the various utopian works. And I want to mention a few more. We talked about Ray Bradbury. He was a more modern writer in the 20th century. His book, Fahrenheit 451, it was turned into a movie. There was another writer by the name of Philip K. Dick, who was born in 1928. He died in 1982. He actually was born right here in Chicago, Illinois, although he was raised in California for most of his life and lived in California. And he wrote a number of science fiction dystopias, stories about societies gone awry, where huge corporations or the state, you know, gained so much power and took over. One of his stories was called Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? And that was turned into a movie called Blade Runner. I'm sure some people out there have seen that with Harrison Ford. And it was a situation in which these androids, robots, were almost human-like, and they had to be controlled. And there was this ex-cop who was sent to terminate a number of them who had escaped from one of the outer worlds and, you know, got back to Earth, and they were trying to stay alive. In other words, to keep these androids were programmed to go defunct, that is, die at a certain time. And these androids were defying that, and they were trying to come back and find their maker and have a sense of more life. And the story becomes very poignant in the sense that we have to try and examine these people and ask ourselves, what makes us human? Are these people human? And I think that's the original title, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? In other words, what makes a person human was the actual topic that this Philip K. Dick was dealing with. And he wrote a number of others. He wrote also a book that became the movie Minority Report with Tom Cruise. And this was a dystopian society in which people were arrested and sent to jail for crimes that they were going to commit. In other words, all the evidence showed that a crime was going to be committed. And it was sort of like the fireman of Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451, where the firemen were sent out to burn books before they caused the problem. The police of this time were sent out to arrest people and put them in jail before they could commit a crime, so that crime did not occur. Even though a person didn't do anything yet, it was predicted that they would. And so it became a very interesting story. And then there was another one that became Total Recall with Arnold Schwarzenegger, and this is where this huge corporation takes over much of Earth, the power on Earth, but specifically on Mars. Mars is inhabited, by human beings. It's being, mined and so forth, and people live in underground tunnels, and they depend on oxygen, and this big corporation provides it, and the corporation totally controls their lives, and that's what the story, is all about. And so, it becomes a very interesting story as well. So Dick wrote some very interesting things. He did spend some time, I do believe, in a mental institution. He suffered from what could be called baby delusions. He was convinced that he had this vision from God, or that he saw God. He was convinced of that, but he understood that it possibly could be a delusion. He sort of wavered back and forth, and it so affected his life. And because of it, he wrote, some of the novels, that he wrote, and they became movies. And most of his life, he just barely lived from hand to mouth, trying to make a living with his writings, and didn't really make a lot of money from them. In the end of his life, when they bought the rights to do Android's Dream of Electric Sheep, the movie, Blade Runner, when they made that, they bought the rights to that novel, and he did make a little bit more money then and was a little bit more well off. But he did say, he said, sometimes the proper response to reality is to go insane. Maybe, in an insane world, and we could see a lot of the absurdities and insanities of our own world, and maybe he could see it too clearly and too much, and maybe that's what affected his mental state. But, that's something to think about. Sometimes the proper response to reality is to go insane. What he was really saying, in a sense, is that you can reach a point in the world where it is the world that is insane, and the people who disagree with it are the ones that are sane. They're called insane. And you have to remember that Jonathan Swift, when he wrote Gulliver's Travels, he was called a misanthrope, a person who hated people, which of course he didn't, and he was also called insane because he wrote these novels about, about society. In other words, all of the absurdities and nuttiness and silliness of the society in which he lived, and the power that was often exercised by princes and kings and people who should have known better. And he also spoke out against the discrimination and treatment of Catholics. You have to remember, during Swift's time, it was against law in England to be a Catholic, and priests and so forth had to hide out, and they would be killed, and they would be killed in horrible, cruel ways. And we'll talk a little bit more about that when we get into Shakespeare, next week. But these are some of the things that actually happened, and Jonathan Swift himself was called insane, and he was called a misanthrope, and he wasn't at all. He was writing...
No, he wasn't, and then he wrote A Modest Proposal.
A Modest Proposal.
And what did it show in there?
It showed that the Modest Proposal was that babies, could be a source of food. They should be eaten. And, of course, this was pure satire. And the idea was to horrify people, at the thought. I mean, it wasn't ever to be taken for real that this would ever really be proposed. And, of course, that's why the name A Modest Proposal, when it was really a preposterous proposal. But the whole idea was, since Catholics were treated so badly and that they were constantly, made to be poor because they couldn't, especially in Ireland. He was writing about the situation in Ireland, where people were literally starved to death during the potato famine. you know, where England controlled and oppressed Ireland to the point where the average people were always on the verge of, you know, starvation and living a very mean and hard and difficult life on account of the treatment they received. He was saying that, in effect, why not just take Irish babies and buy them from their mothers when they become old enough to eat? In the meantime, the mothers would be given enough sustenance to take care of them and fatten them up and so forth, so that they would become a very good table meal for the wealthy. And what he was doing was satirizing the horror with which Catholics were treated in Ireland. And, of course, he was called sort of insane for that as well. But what's going on today, Lynn?
Oh, didn't I hear last night on the news or in one of these programs I was watching last night that they're talking about something very similar?
Yes, they are. They're actually talking about, you know, in order to save the earth, we should be eating our pets. And then some people have gone so far as to say that people should be turned into food. And this brings us to another dystopian novel and also a dystopian movie, and that's Soylent Green, in which you have a dystopian future that the world is dying, you know, that the people have ruined the planet, and they're living off the algae in the ocean, and Soylent Green is the company that makes that algae into food. But since the algae itself is dying, Soylent Green, the company, is now taking people and turning them into some kind of a flour, like, you know, powder that can be used as protein. And it's called Soylent Green. In other words, it's the name of it. And the Soylent Company is the one that's doing this. And this one policeman finds it out. And we have now people today in our modern day, who, you know, suggesting this as being real. We should be eating people in order to save the planet. And we should be killing cows and stop eating meat in order to save the planet. I mean, someone needs to write novels like this in order to show us the absurdity and idiocy of which, you know, we're doing. Of course, we need to take care of our planet and be good stewards, but not to the point, you know, of destroying humanity in trying to do so, of raising nature up to some kind of a goddess that is over and above everything.
Right. You know, you look at these writers and so forth, they're almost like the modern day prophets.
Yeah.
What they've said, some of this inkling, it horrifies you to read about it, and you think this is fantasy. And then it's coming true.
It turns out these people are pretty prescient. We're beginning to see the Fahrenheit 451 is anti-free speech and anti-literature.
Right, the only free speech
movement
you're supposed to have is if you agree with them.
Yeah, right.
With the opposition.
With the opposition. And so, you know, taking a look at some of this stuff, would it be proper for Philip Dick's saying to become true? Sometimes a proper response to reality is to go insane, meaning, in effect, you know, if the world
is... You have to be insane to live in this world, huh?
If the world is being turned upside down, then it's the so-called insane person that happens to be right side up. This is what is going on here. And
look at with the abortion movement today. They're killing these babies, but they're developed enough they can take parts from these babies and sell them. To give to other, you know, to supposedly help other people.
Exactly.
And what's the next step? We're taking the next step for this, next step for that. If you just look down the line, where's this going to end up?
The next step will be a company like Soylent Green raising babies for parts, for body parts. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that's a possibility.
Well, and then you have end of life. They're saying you shouldn't suffer. And, you know, euthanasia.
Exactly.
Well, that's what Soylent Green was about.
Exactly. Christ came to teach us that we can give up our suffering, you know, for something greater and offer it up to God. And that suffering can be then turned into something positive instead of something negative, because it's going to happen to us whether we like it or not. These people are, in effect, saying they can end suffering altogether. But if they do, they end human beings and human nature. We need to explore, as Philip Dick did, what is human nature? This is what, Pope and Swift and others, the writers of an earlier times, the 18th century writers, asked. In other words, what is human nature? And the answers are difficult, and these questions need to be addressed. Instead, we have modern society that seems to say that all of these are of no import at all, and that only factual knowledge is necessary. Well, factual knowledge, you can see what happened in France, and you can see where factual knowledge can go. It really doesn't offer any solution to the problems of human nature, and until we begin to take that into account and understand human nature, we won't really be able to formulate a society. You know, we can't just formulate a society on a piece of paper without taking into consideration human nature. And for that, we've had 2,000 years of the Catholic Church and Catholic teaching, and we've got good, solid teaching that did build Western civilization and did work, and we need to be turning to that, turning to what, you know, what worked. It sort of reminds me, remember during the Civil War when it first started, when it first the South was proposing to secede from the Union, and then South Carolina finally did, I think one of the newspapers in the South wrote that South Carolina was too big for an insane asylum and too little for a country.
Yes.
And if you think about it, I mean, you know, are we becoming a whole nation, you know, as an insane asylum? If you start taking a look at what's going on in reality and what's being proposed, I mean, this
right.
by some of the people, the solutions to our problems that they're proposing, I mean, they are, you know, talking about eating people. They're talking about eating our pets.
In the bark off a tree. Well,
yeah.
Okay. Aspirin was derived from some tree and tree barks. There are things to do with that. But she also worried about hurting the tree. If she took the bark off to get the nourishment out of the bark, what if it hurts the tree?
What Lynn is talking about is, it was on the news, it was one of the pundits, one of the ladies, some girl, I can't remember her name, on, you know, proposing, talking about these solutions. She didn't propose them all, but she was talking about some of these proposed solutions. And somehow or another, we should be...
Right. You know, we shouldn't eat meat.
Right. We should go back to insects, eating insects or eating... I mean, this is ridiculous. The fact is that there are all kinds of animals and so forth that eat insects naturally. I mean, the world is already working, and we're in it. We're part of it. And we have to learn to live with it and be good stewards and so forth, but we can't turn ourselves into something that we're not. We have a human nature. And if that goes, what's the purpose even of having a civilization or being alive at all? And what gods are we worshiping here? You know, this is what Dick was talking about, I think, with this, when the world becomes a huge insane asylum, the people that are sane are called, you know, insane.
Insane.
And that's...
That's what Paul predicted back in when he was talking about the end times, that they won't know good from evil. And we certainly have come to that point. It's very frightening in a lot of ways of what human nature can actually turn into.
Exactly. He was saying we'll call, you know, evil good and good evil. And that can easily happen. And human beings, I mean, our nature is such that we can be easily led into these dystopian futures. And we have to be very cautious and careful of it. And so... the utopian literature is a way of doing that, and we should all be aware of it and be aware that some of these things are very prophetic and are really not to be laughed at. I mean, I can remember reading some of these books way back in the 1960s, and people say, oh, well, this is never going to really happen. Well, the fact is a lot of it seems to be happening right now. We can engineer people, you know, genetically and so forth, but the fact is that what makes us human? And one of the things that makes us human, of course, is the fact that we're religious. And
we've sure gotten away from Joseph Pierce here.
We have. But at any rate, I'm going to finish it here. This pragmatic nearsightedness.
This is Pierce now?
Yeah. He's saying here, the dystopian novels, in other words, this pragmatic nearsightedness that they show. They're showing that we often are very pragmatic, meaning that, you know, practical. And he said often this practicality is simply nearsightedness masquerading as realism. And it puts its trust in the myopia of the market, which we have too much of maybe today. and a lot of the hedonism, that is, the, you know, just goods, 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 material, 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 that somehow this will all make us happy. And he says, the market has no way of measuring or seeing anything but the present. And the myopia of our media-manipulated democracy, he's saying that the media manipulates our democracy, and it does. I mean, the media, as you were saying, Lynn, they have to be honest, and they have to take their profession seriously and try to get at the truth instead of simply get at what they happen to believe and hide the truth. And it goes on, he says, we have in our society of a democracy no inclination to see beyond the next election a lot of times. I mean, we have one side and the other simply opposed to each other to see who can get elected. And the point is that it shouldn't be who can get elected. It should be how can we run society in such a way
that it's good for all men,
good for everyone, and make it the best society that can be. And what is the best? And we have to define these things. And they're not just a matter of who can convince people to vote for them. So at any point, at any rate, we're getting down to the end of the program. We'll have to stop here. We're going to come back next week, and we'll talk about Shakespeare a little bit more.
No, it'll be the week after.
Or the week after. Next week, that's right. We're going to have Charlotte Glass on, and we're going to talk about Eucharistic miracles, so that'll be next week. So right now, we're going to end our program with our usual prayer.
Yes, really plead with St. Michael to come and rescue us and help us, because if you look around, you can see what's going on.
St. Michael, the archangel, defend us in battle. Be our protection against the wickedness and snares of the devil. May God rebuke him, we humbly pray. And do thou, O Prince of the heavenly hosts, by the power of God, thrust into hell Satan and all evil spirits who wandered the world for the ruin of souls. Amen.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5. If you'd like to contact Bob, email bob@catholicspiritradio.com. Again, that's bob@catholicspiritradio.com. Catholic Spirit Radio relies on your support to bring programming like this and EWTN to Central Illinois 24 hours a day. Please help keep Catholic Spirit Radio on the air with your generous support. Donate online at catholicspiritradio.com. Or send a donation to Catholic Spirit Radio, 108 Boykins Place, Normal, Illinois, 61761. That's Catholic Spirit Radio, 108 Boykins Place, Normal, Illinois, 61761. Catholic Spirit Radio is a 501c3, and all donations are tax deductible. Thank you for your support of Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.